Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the show. And today, I'm thrilled to welcome John Roth back to the show. John has written a fascinating new book. It's titled Sources of Holocaust Insight, and I think it might be different than any of the other books I've discussed in doing 110 or so odd interviews for the show. It's a reflection, a tribute, maybe kind of a valedictory, all at once. And in it, he reflects on the people who have taught him, on all the different ways teaching can happen, and the lessons he's learned over decades of thinking and writing and reflecting about the Holocaust. And here, I guess I should say, maybe lessons is a word, but maybe not the only word. And we'll ask him about that as we go along. It's a rich book. And we're only going to have a chance to dip our toes into it, but I think it's well worth exploring, and I'm looking forward to doing that. So, John, welcome to the show again, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm really delighted to be with you again. This is an important show you do, and I'm honored to be with you.
Well, you've been with us before, but it's been a while. Maybe you could take a minute or two or three and just reintroduce yourself to listeners who may not know your work.
Sure. I spent my career basically teaching in a small liberal arts college in California called Claremont McKenna College. I'm a philosopher by training, but as I like to say, I'm a philosopher who got tripped up by history, and in particular by the history of the Holocaust when I was early on in my career as a young professor. And so for most of my life, 50 years or so, I've spent working on the Holocaust and genocide, bringing the perspectives and training that I had as a young person in the field of philosophy. And I live now in rural Washington State. I've been retired in quotes for about 10 years, but I continue to be active and I love to write. And in the COVID-19 era that we're in, I've been able to, as we say, work from home, and I continue to enjoy doing that.
So I wonder, you and I guess are in some ways similar in the sense that we both started our career intending or not recognizing that we would spend our lives thinking about mass violence. I wonder if you've reflected on what it has meant to your study of the Holocaust that you didn't start there. Many people now, right, Holocaust studies and genocide studies is now a field and people go to grad school. Do you see any different ways that you approach the field given that you didn't start there?
Well, I think so. I think it has to do with the fact that my approach to the Holocaust comes by the path of philosophical studies. Mm. And at first, when I was training in philosophy, the Holocaust was not primarily on my mind. Genocide was not primarily on my mind. But questions about justice and suffering and evil definitely were in the mix. So as I look back, I can see that although it took me some time to take the turn that I did in moving into Holocaust and genocide studies, my early preparation in philosophy sort of set me up for that when the Holocaust, as I like to say, and genocide found me more than I found them. It was as if the things I was studying and thinking and reading and experiencing were sort of preparing me for this turn that my personal and professional life took when I was in my early 30s and I really began to concentrate specifically on the Holocaust.
So this, I think you've been on the show three times. This book is different. So tell us a little bit about why you wanted to write this book at this time, and how did you try and think through it and organize it and structure it?
I'm a person who has been deeply influenced by books. Mm-hmm. And one of the books that affected me very deeply is a book by Raoul Hilberg, one of the great pioneers and scholars of the Holocaust. He's best known for his three-volume, multiple-edition book called The Destruction of the European Jews. But I was very impressed about 20 years ago when Hilberg published a small book called Sources of Holocaust Research. And what he did in this book was to reflect on the sources. They were primarily for him documents that had informed and influenced his understanding of the Holocaust. And he talked about these as sources of his understanding of how the destruction process had taken place. I used this book some in my teaching, and it left a deep impression on me just because of the approach that Hilberg took, where he was stepping back to look at the things that had influenced his understanding of the Holocaust and the destruction process that was central to it. And as I grew older and began to reflect back on the fact that, you know, I'd spent about 50 years now working on the Holocaust, I realized that I have sources of Holocaust, not research specifically, but what I came to call insight. And my sources were books, testimonies, people, events, a whole variety of things that I realized had really influenced and informed my thinking about the Holocaust and what I had taken away from my study of that event. And so I thought, you know, maybe I've got a book here that is about sources of what I came to call Holocaust insight. So Hilberg was kind of in the background of this as a person who had written a book that became sort of an example for me of something that maybe I could and needed to write, if only for myself, about the sources of understanding that had informed and influenced my grasp of the Holocaust and its implications. And so that was the impetus behind it. I worked on the book for a couple of years, and it appeared earlier this year in 2020.
You mentioned this for this idea of insight. Maybe let's start a discussion of the book there. What do you mean when you say Holocaust insight?
The epigraph for my book comes from a proverb in the Hebrew Bible, which says, whatever else you get, this is in the English translation that I use, whatever else you get insight. And insight for me is a word that refers to an understanding that goes deep down. It has to do with the kind of grasp that one gets after living with something for a long time, thinking through something for a long time, and realizing that you have a perspective or a grasp of things that still may be full of questions and uncertainties, but it has the quality of a perspective on things. Insight isn't reducible, I think, to lessons. We often talk about, you know, are there lessons from the Holocaust or lessons from genocide? It's bigger and broader than the concept of lessons, I think, the notion of insight, as I grasp it, turns out to be. But it entails, in a nutshell, a kind of broad perspective or understanding of things that, as I say, kind of goes deep down, so that it involves the emotions, the feelings, the ethical outlooks, maybe even the spiritual understanding that a person may get from encountering and confronting an event or an experience that is immense in its scope and implications.
So as you talk about the insight you gain, the first three chapters in some ways seem to me a conversation, and it's a conversation that the people who are featured in those chapters are having with each other, and a conversation you're having with them. And these are conversations about faith and the implication of the Holocaust for faith. I'd like to start with something you write. You say, "No example of mass murder exceeds the Holocaust in raising so directly or so insistently the question of how, or even whether, such a catastrophe can be reconciled with God's providential involvement in history." You start with Richard Rubinstein and his attempt to wrestle with this question. Can you say something about how he tried to answer questions about God and faith in the light of the Holocaust?
Yes, to do that, I need to go back a little bit into my own biography, because Rubinstein is the first person I discuss in the book as one of the key sources of my Holocaust insight. In 1966, as I was finishing up my PhD work at Yale University, Rubinstein published a very important book called After Auschwitz. I read that book when I was, you know, finishing up my graduate study, and I was fascinated by it. And a few years later, but before I had kind of fully immersed myself in study of the Holocaust, I actually wrote something about Rubinstein and his explorations in After Auschwitz. And Rubinstein has become a close and dear friend. We have collaborated together in writing projects and known each other for a long, long time now. And he's been a deeply influential friend and thinker for me, and very definitely one of my sources of Holocaust insight. One of the things that Rubinstein stressed about the Holocaust was that the people who were targeted by the Holocaust, the Jewish people, are people who have had their identity profoundly shaped by their religious tradition. And so the fact that the Jews were Hitler's targets, for Rubinstein, who is himself an ordained rabbi, raised, among other things, profoundly religious questions, because the tradition that Jewish people have had religiously has suggested that there is a special relationship between God and Jewish people, a covenant. Rubinstein, reflecting on the Holocaust, came to the conclusion that the perspective, the theology of a covenantal relationship between the Jewish people and God was no longer credible. The Holocaust, which was not the first event of a kind that had called into question that covenantal relationship, but for Rubinstein, the Holocaust became kind of a pivotal moment that seemed to shatter a long-standing tradition religiously. That is also a tradition that has informed not just Judaism and a Jewish religious and philosophical thinking, but has deeply influenced the Christian tradition, which happens to be the tradition that I grew up in and that I, you know, still identify with. So Rubinstein's reflections on the shattering effect of the Holocaust for a tradition that had deeply influenced and informed, especially Western civilization for centuries, was, for my encounter with Rubinstein's thinking, was fundamental. It started in a way that seemed like it was not so central for me, but Rubinstein grew in importance to me as my life continued, and I began to move from my training in 1966 as a young PhD in philosopher into a professor in his early 30s who took a turn that took me directly and permanently into the field of Holocaust and genocide studies. Rubinstein, just to add a note on this, Rubinstein, I think, has ended up with an outlook that is still rooted in Judaism. Rubinstein had questions about the covenantal relationship between God and the Jewish people. He even has deep questions about, you know, the reality of God, but he still identifies to this day with Jewish tradition. And I think he does this in a way that to me is reminiscent of some of the themes that I also talk about in the book that come from the French philosopher and literary figure Albert Camus.
And at the same time as you're working with and engaging with Rubinstein, you're getting to know and then know better Elie Wiesel. How did you meet Wiesel?
I met Wiesel, this is fitting with an earlier theme that we've talked about. I met Wiesel first through his writings. And it was a college professor, a friend of mine, Frederick Sontag, who also he and I later taught together and wrote together and did a variety of things together. It was Frederick Sontag who suggested to me one day in the early 1970s that he thought I might be interested in reading some of Elie Wiesel's writings. And so I like to say, I always did what my professors told me to do when they suggested books I should read. So I followed Frederick Sontag's suggestion, and I began to read Elie Wiesel. I did this in the summer of 1972, at the time that I was about to become a father for the second time. My spouse was about to give birth to a daughter. I have an older child who is a son, but I was reading about Wiesel's experiences at a time when, you know, my life was going forward very nicely. I was a successful young professor. I had a family. I had a good career going, and I was reading in following my professor friend's suggestion. I was reading about the antithesis of everything that I was experiencing. I was reading about the destruction of hope, the destruction of family, loss of opportunity and the destruction of a way of life. And this was a kind of collision in my experience that eventually led to, as I like to think of it, my life taking both a professional and a personal turn. And the turn was directly into the field of study of the Holocaust. And it was a very simple kind of thing. I was reading Wiesel, and he's talking like Rubinstein had done, although in a very different way, about how Wiesel was talking about how his experiences in the Holocaust had totally changed his religious outlook. Mm. And I was experiencing a version of this as a young Christian philosopher. And I said, I've just got to find out more about this history and about this experience. And so that's what happened for me. And I plunged into it. And my reading took me all sorts of places, including into the reading of the writing of Ralph Hilberg and a lot of other people. And it was a professional change for me because it reoriented what I was doing as a scholar and a teacher. And it was a personal challenge because I realized that study of the Holocaust was challenging my own identity as a Christian. And I still live with that. And I was having to find out more about this event, partly because a tradition that was meaningful to me had ended up being deeply, deeply implicated in the genocide against the Jewish people. And that is a dilemma and a pain that haunts me still and keeps me kind of working on these topics and questions.
Yeah, one of the subject of your next, and we'll come back to Wiesel in a minute, but the subject of your next chapter, Franklin, and I don't know, is it Littell or Littell?
Franklin Littell. Uh-huh.
I've read Rubinstein and Wiesel. I've never read Littell, but you quote him as saying, "The Holocaust is the unfinished business of the Christian churches, the running sore unattended by its leaders and weakening to its constituents." He wrote this a while back. Is this still true?
The relationship between Christianity and Christians and the Holocaust is a long history and an unfinished history, mm-hmm. and in many ways a deeply unsatisfying history. Let me contextualize it just a little bit by observing that a few weeks ago, just about the time that the COVID-19 pandemic really hit the world, the Vatican had opened its archives about Pope Pius XII, who was the controversial and I would say problematic pope during the Nazi era. And the reason why the opening of these archives has been so long awaited and was anticipated with so much eagerness by scholars was that it was hoped that with the opening of these archives, we would at last get some further insight about who Pius XII was and what his posture amounted to during the time of the Holocaust. So that work has been put on hold a little bit because of the pandemic. Yeah. But the reason I mention it at all here in response to your question is that the relationship between Christianity and the Holocaust and the Jewish people and the genocide is fraught and vexed because in general, it's understood that as I like to put it, absent Christianity, there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. Mm-hmm. The long history of Christian animosity toward Judaism and the Jewish people only became really corrected to the extent that it has been because of the catastrophe of the, you know, what the Nazis called the final solution of the Jewish question. So this remains kind of an open wound in many ways. But the one of the problems is that for contemporary Christianity, it remains ignored. It hasn't been addressed in the way that it should be. And this was Littell's mission, to go back to Franklin Littell. He was a Christian theologian, historian, who had spent time in Germany as Hitler came to power, and later after the war, as an advisor to the American occupation force in the defeated Nazi Germany. And this influenced Littell very deeply because he became aware of the complicity of the Christian churches in Germany, the complicity of those churches with the Third Reich. And his mission became to try to understand that, to call attention to it, and to try to deal with what he called in his best-known book, The Crucifixion of the Jews. That book was Littell's attempt to try to come to terms with Christianity's complicity in the Holocaust. It was a book that was published in the mid-1970s, and it left an influence on people of my generation, who were slightly younger than Littell, but a younger generation of Christians who were sensitized by Littell and some other people to the need for Christianity to confront the Holocaust. And so Littell became another of the sources of Holocaust insight for me, because I learned from him that my own identity as a Christian required me to grapple with the Holocaust and its implications.
So you mentioned COVID-19. I will just briefly take a break and mention to the listeners that, like so many other podcasters and even radio broadcasters, one of the impacts is that I've been forced out of my office and into my home, and doing this in a podcast closet, which apparently is too close to an outer wall. So if you hear a lawnmower in the background, I apologize. It should be done soon. One of the things that comes out of your essays on Rubinstein and Wiesel is the sustained interrogation of the Holocaust as a challenge and as a, I don't know, inspiration is not the right word, but as something that forces Jews to come to terms with this experience. How do you have a sense of why Christians have been less willing to do that kind of reflection?
It's a good question, and it varies depending on what else is going on in the world. Mm. There was a time when Littell wrote his book, The Crucifixion of the Jews, in 1975. I think there was, at that time, there was much more willingness and openness on the part of Christians to grapple with this. It wasn't too much later. The Lutheran Church, in particular, had to grapple with the fact that Martin Luther had written in ways that were very hostile to Jews and Judaism. Some of his texts were picked up by the Nazis and used. So there was a kind of period in the mid-70s and 80s when Protestant Christians were thinking more explicitly about the Holocaust and how they needed to address their own tradition. And then in the Catholic Church, there were positive developments that took place with the publication of a document called Nostra Aetate that kind of owned up to many of the Catholic Church's shortcomings with regard to Jewish-Catholic relationships. And then as events unfolded going on now into the 21st century, I would say that the churches have paid less attention to the Holocaust. Mm. And there are reasons for that. Just have to do, I mean, as is the case with all of these atrocity events that we study, they eventually recede into the past in some ways. And so there is a struggle to keep attention directed toward them. There are arguments about how relevant is it to keep paying attention to these things. And it's a struggle. So this is a debate that continues, but it remains alive, and it will have some renewed attention, partly because, as I mentioned a few moments ago, there's the opening of the archives about Pius the XII. So things come and go a little bit, as we know, in the events that involve keeping attention focused on historical events. I've been interested, for example, I wrote about Albert Camus as one of the sources of Holocaust insight in my book. And Camus is suddenly back in a central place intellectually in our time here in 2020, because Camus wrote a very influential novel called The Plague. And there are all sorts of comments now about the importance of rereading Camus and thinking about this French philosopher who, you know, had always been of interest to many people, but now he's kind of come back into a central place in human awareness. So the attention that events get can wax and wane a bit, depending on, you know, what's happening in the larger social and political context.
I'd like to come back to Wiesel just for a minute, because at least in the United States, in many states anyway, his book Night is the first and maybe only common reading that young people do in school about the Holocaust. It is assigned in many classes in high schools, people read it. My daughter actually read it recently. And then they leave Wiesel and never come back. So what would you tell my daughter or listeners? What's important about Wiesel's thinking or about Wiesel's witnessing that they should know after they're done with Night?
My interest in Wiesel was aroused and sustained by two major things, I think I would say. Wiesel is a writer who is gripped by the importance of questions. This appealed to me very much as a philosopher when I read him. Wiesel says sometimes that questions are more important than answers, because questions, you know, keep us moving. They keep us thinking. They leave things open. They don't prematurely close inquiry. Instead, what they do is they open up inquiry. And I love that part about Wiesel and his writings. He's always in the things that he's writing, and very often in the public lectures that he gave, he would be exploring questions and sometimes in frustrating ways, kind of not answering them. And the reason that he wouldn't always, you know, end up with answers to the questions was that he thought that the answers were confining, and that there was even something dangerous about answers to big questions, because the answers might make us feel reassured or might make us feel that we knew more than we actually knew. So I think the the importance of questions in Wiesel's thinking is something that makes him a kind of perennial favorite of mine. Related to that is the fact that you can't read Wiesel without encountering religious questions. Yeah. He was a person who was unabashedly immersed in the traditions of Judaism, and the questions that he had again and again were questions about that religious tradition, questions about God, questions about the relationship between God and injustice. Wiesel wrote a play that he called The Trial of God. And the combination of his interest in questions and his interest in his own religious tradition was that very often in his writings, the questioning is directed toward God in a way that puts God on trial. But in Wiesel's view, without rejecting God in the process. And I found this very, very interesting and instructive and insightful in Wiesel's work. It is, however, one of the things that makes some scholars less happy with Wiesel than they are with some other people who have reflected on the Holocaust. So not everyone, you know, likes Knight so much. And not everyone is eager to recommend Wiesel as the person who should be read as often as he is in this field.
In the book, you use the phrase, in spite of joy. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, I put the inflection just a little different, not in spite of joy, but in spite of joy, as a kind of joy. I make this point in the context of thinking about the fact that often when we're working in Holocaust and genocide studies, we have the problem of encountering despair and realizing that no matter how hard we try, we don't seem to emerge victorious against the forces that are destructive and murderous. Two sources of insight affected me here and led me to think about a joy that is in spite of despair. In spite of atrocity. And the two sources are a Holocaust scholar, philosopher named Philip Halley, for one. Halley was a person who was deeply influenced by what happened in a French village called Les Chambons, where he learned about French Huguenot Protestants who had helped to rescue Jews during the Holocaust. And he wrote a book about that community. He also wrote about ethics. He was a philosopher who was interested in ethics. And he says at one point, and this puzzled me for a long time, he says, if ethics doesn't produce joy, then it really isn't worth bothering about it. And I wondered for a long time, what does he mean by that? How is it possible that ethics is only valuable to the extent that it produces joy? It's a puzzling idea. And then I got some insight about this by revisiting Albert Camus. Camus and Halley were friendly. They knew each other, and Halley was deeply influenced by Camus. And Camus has a piece that for me has become kind of emblematic of an ethical outlook that I appreciate very much. Camus wrote a piece called The Myth of Sisyphus, which is a story about a figure from mythology who challenges the gods and is having to pay a price for that. And the price he has to pay is that he has to roll a boulder up a hill, only to have it roll back down. And he is condemned in perpetuity to having to roll the boulder back up the hill. Camus reflects on Sisyphus and concludes that a Sisyphus, who is a rebellious person, he says that he envisions that Sisyphus is happy, and that he even experiences joy as he is condemned to carry out this act of pushing that rock up the hill, even though he knows it's going to come back down. And what I take away from this is that it is possible, maybe even important, to experience a kind of deep meaning that can have a quality of joy about it that is found in the act of resistance, the act of persevering, even in the face of defeat, against forces that are joy-destroying, life-destroying. So it's a form of what I call in spite of joy. It's a kind of feeling that emerges from saying, I refuse to let these forces of evil prevail, even if they do prevail, as long as I have life and breath to try to resist them. And in the process, I think it is possible, maybe even important, to have the experience of joy in that. And I think this was what Halley meant when he said that if ethics doesn't produce joy, it isn't worth it. It isn't worth pursuing it. So that for Halley, what I think he was saying is that as you pursue the ethical way of life, even knowing that it may not prevail, it has got to give you a deep meaning to be worth persisting and not giving up on that effort. I call that an in spite of joy.
So we've talked mostly so far about thinkers and philosophers and theologians, which makes perfect sense, but you actually feature historians and history prominently in this book, and you're deeply influenced by a number of historians. And you mentioned Raoul Hilberg already, so maybe I'll just use him as an example. How has Hilberg personally, and maybe historians broadly, how has that shaped the way you understand and investigate the Holocaust?
Yes. Historians are absolutely essential for understanding or encountering or questioning or inquiring about the Holocaust. They are the people who go to the sources, go to the documents. They are the keepers of the records. They are the people who help us to understand what happened. They help us understand how it happened, and even to a large degree, why it happened. So I have the greatest admiration for historians. And one of the chapters in my book is devoted to the historians who have influenced me significantly. They include Hilberg, who was actually a political scientist, but who was also deeply immersed in historical research, but also people and friends of mine like Yehuda Bauer and Christopher Browning and Peter Hayes, and Michael Maris and Devorah Dwork and, you know, many, many others, more than I can name here, all of whom have helped me, enabled me to think about the Holocaust at all. Without them, I would be really ignorant and left without the knowledge that anyone needs in order to think responsibly about these things. But my training as a philosopher and as a person interested in religious questions and interested in the ethical issues and reverberations of the Holocaust also makes me understand, it helps to give me the insight that historical approaches to these events are not the only approaches that can be taken, and they by themselves may not be even sufficient, that there are questions that more historical research can't address. And so there has to be willingness, the boldness to try to explore them from other angles. And these include literature, art, psychology, philosophy, religious studies. I think at the end of the day, the study of the Holocaust and the study of genocide and mass atrocities is an enterprise that does not belong, cannot belong to any one academic discipline. It requires teamwork. It requires complementarity, cooperation that involves a lot of different approaches if we are to achieve the kind of understanding and insight that we get by inquiring about these events.
Yeah, and that's maybe a point to cite a conversation you mentioned in the book with a co-author of yours, Carol Rittner. I don't know that you had edited anything with her at the point she made this, but you say right after your book, Holocaust, Religious and Philosophical Implications, came out, you were talking with her, and Rittner asked you, where are the women? And I don't remember exactly that you described your answer, but I picture you kind of silent for a moment as you wrestled on the phone with that question. How then has that question shaped your work on and thinking about the Holocaust? And is it just a new set of material to analyze, or does it shape or reshape the kind of guiding frames you use in thinking about the subject?
One of the things that I think is an insight that I gather from all the work that I've done on the Holocaust, and this could apply to other genocides too, but I think I feel it particularly with regard to the Holocaust, is the vastness of this event. Mm. That might seem obvious, but for me, the vastness has grown as I have studied and found that my study has had to expand in ways that I didn't first imagine. And one of the ways that my work has had to expand has involved what we would call presently kind of an openness to the gendered dimensions of the Holocaust. When I was working on this early on, there wasn't very much attention paid to what had happened to women or what the role of women in the Holocaust was, or how women's perspectives in scholarship might affect and change and alter our understanding of what was going on. But now, 30 or 35 years later, this is one of the ways in which the field of Holocaust studies, and I would say it's true of genocide studies too, is different than it was, you know, decades ago. Because today, you simply can't begin to understand what had happened in a genocide, or in the Holocaust in particular, without trying your best to take into account what happened to women and children and men and people of different sexual orientations and things of that kind as well. But it wasn't always that way in this field. So when Carol Rittner, early in the 1990s, I guess, you know, asked me about one of the books I'd worked on, Where Are the Women? This came as a kind of a jolt of recognition for me. And one of the things that happened was that Carol Rittner and I teamed up, as we've done very often in work that we've done together, and we did a book called Women and the Holocaust, which turns out to have had a kind of small but significant part in opening up the field of Holocaust studies to a more inclusive orientation that includes now an emphasis on gender, and in particular on the roles that women played in that particular catastrophe. So since that time, I have paid more attention to issues about women, and in particular, violence against women in genocide and in the Holocaust than I would have, you know, been doing 35 or 40 years ago. So it was a place where my understanding of the Holocaust had to change in order to be adequate at all to the history that I was trying to confront and grasp. And it has to do with this theme that I take away from my study of the Holocaust, that the vastness of this event, if anything, keeps growing.
That's maybe that, yeah. So it is a vast subject, but in many Americans' eyes, it gets condensed into one place, and that's Auschwitz.
Yes.
And of course, you feature several witnesses or survivors, or Wiesel and Levy and others, whose experience is broadly the experience, and Delbo, the experience is what many, that's what people read, that's their image in their mind. They've seen Schindler's List, where there's that moment in Auschwitz. And yet one of the things we've discovered over the last decade is that that experience is a Holocaust experience, but that there are many other kinds of Holocaust experiences. So what do you think we should do with this image or place of Auschwitz as we think about the Holocaust and as you think about ethics?
Well, I think you put it very well. And this is one of the things that goes with the theme about vastness, and the other related theme that there just isn't closure to our understanding about the Holocaust. We keep learning new things about it, about what happened, and this is where the historical research is so important, that it be sustained and supported, and that it continue. So to go back to your point, there was a time, and it still exists to some extent, where Auschwitz was kind of the emblem of the Holocaust, and what it suggested was massive industrialized destruction, industrialized in the sense that Auschwitz was a place where almost on an assembly line basis, it turned out, hundreds of thousands of people were gassed and destroyed. But as we've learned more, it isn't that Auschwitz is displaced as an important location for this genocide, but it is obviously the case now more than maybe we understood 30 years ago, one of many, many places. And some of the places are sites where what has come to be called by some the Holocaust by bullets took place, shooting sites where, it turns out many, many thousands of people were murdered, not in gas chambers, but simply by shooting squadrons. It's not that we didn't know about those shooting squadrons before, but the extent of what was done by those squads of killers has become increased in our awareness of its extensiveness. And so the Holocaust is now an event that can't be reduced, if it ever was reduced, to a place like Auschwitz. Nevertheless, Auschwitz, I think, does remain as a important, undeniably important location for the Holocaust and an important symbol of what the Holocaust aimed for, which was an industrialized destruction of an entire people. It could have been allowed to continue in the way that it was intended.
We've talked about books and people as sources of insight, but maybe we could spend just a moment talking about place. You talk about visiting some of the places that you've been studying. And in particular, you tell a story about visiting Auschwitz and then seeing a rainbow. I wonder if you could tell listeners that story and say something about what it means to you.
I think places are very important in all sorts of ways for anyone who studies the Holocaust. There was a time when I felt a real need to visit some of the places where things had happened that I was studying about. And I thought, well, if I could do that, if I could visit those places, then I would really understand things much, much more. What I found was also an insight that emerged, which was that, yes, it was important to visit these places, but it was not necessarily the case that I understood anything more by visiting them. I did understand some things. But it wasn't that by going to Treblinka or going to Warsaw, Poland, or being in the, what was at the time, the USSR, that my knowledge of the Holocaust automatically increased because of that. But I did have experiences at those places that were insightful. And one of them that I remember took place at Auschwitz. I was traveling with a group of other Holocaust scholars, and we were in Auschwitz, actually at the place in Auschwitz called Birkenau, which was the part of the vast complex there that was the place where the killing center, the gas chambers were. And we were there one afternoon, and as a group of Jewish scholars were gathering together to say Kaddish, which is the traditional Jewish prayer for the dead. This was happening during a thunderstorm. And as that prayer was being said on that occasion, a rainbow came out over that that site. And that image has never left me because of the juxtaposition of the beauty of the rainbow and the horror of the place. The rainbow is a symbol of hope. It's a symbol that has biblical implications. When the great flood takes place that nearly destroys the world, a rainbow comes out. So the image of a rainbow over Auschwitz, which I'm sure happened during some days when the destruction process there was underway, this is a haunting image for me.
Yeah, I'm reminded in, I think, if I'm remembering right, Primo Levi has a chapter in his book simply titled A Good Day. And it is a reminder that we need to be nuanced and open in thinking about experiences. We're nearing the end of our time, but I'd like to ask, in your chapter on Kaufman and Delbo, you talk about rights. And you talk about, you suggest, I think, that rights only become meaningful when enforced by people with the ability or maybe the power to enforce them. Is that a, that can be read very pessimistically, or maybe not. Maybe you could say something about how you came to that conclusion and what you mean by that.
Yes, I'll come back to Kaufman and Delbo in just a second, but I want to reference another person I write about, which is a way of getting at kind of the experience of pessimism and human rights. Toward the end of the book, I write about a Jewish philosopher who was also a survivor of Auschwitz. His name is Sean Amari. And Amari was tortured by the Gestapo before he was sent from Belgium to Auschwitz. And he writes about how his experience of torture, he says, destroyed his trust in the world. And for Amari, this meant that you couldn't just assume that there was such a thing as human rights. Trust in the world was destroyed, he thought, by his experience of torture and by the Holocaust. But yet the notion of human rights continues, it persists, and even in some ways after the Holocaust and after genocide with greater intensity, that is the need for human rights to be affirmed and to be upheld and defended is greater than ever, even in a world where trust in the existence of things like human rights may be compromised, if not lost. So I think that the takeaway for me, the insight, and Sarah Kaufman, Charlotte Delbo, John Amari are thinkers who reflect very deeply on this. They're a little bit like Elie Wiesel and God. They don't want to give up on the notion of human rights, because to do that would be to let despair prevail, to let evil prevail. So they still want to retain the idea of rights, but insist that the only way that human rights can be credible is if human beings are prepared to defend them, to resist the powers that would destroy them. to affirm their importance in spite of all the things that seem to call them into question. And I think that's a credible position to hold. It seems to be an important position to hold. It's a little bit like Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill. It's important to affirm the reality and the existence and importance of human rights, especially in spite of the fact that they are under threat perpetually.
Well, that seems a good place to end. So I'll ask you the last two questions I always ask people. One is, and I'm going to rephrase this a little bit because I've asked you this question in another form before, but so I know this is an impossible choice, but for non-specialists, people who are not, many of our listeners are studied history or political science or philosophy in, as an undergrad, but then went off into business and are not specialists. What of these books would you suggest for somebody who is interested in the subject, but maybe doesn't have a lot of background in it? Where should they start?
Okay, I'll make three or four quick suggestions here that I think could be interesting experiences for anyone to have if they were exploring things that are related to what we've been talking about. I mentioned the philosopher ethicist Philip Halley. His name is spelled Hallie. He wrote a wonderful book which has two different titles. It, I think, can be found in paperback still. In one of its forms, it's called The Eye of the Hurricane. Mm. And in another form, it's called Tales of Good and Evil, Help and Harm. This is a book that is a great read. It talks about Halley's experience as a member of the American Army during World War II. It talks about his experiences in studying the village I mentioned called Les Chambons, where the French people helped to rescue Jews during the Holocaust. And it even has some linkages to Halley's friendship and relationship with Albert Camus. So, The Eye of the Hurricane, Tales of Good and Evil, Help and Harm by Philip Halley is a good place. In line with other things that are being recommended presently in our kind of pandemic phase, Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, is a good read that anyone reading it, I think, will see how it has some possible connection to World War II and the Holocaust. So I'd recommend that. And then for something, two things that would be completely different. If some of your readers are interested in poetry, I found very helpful reading the poetry of an American poet named Kay Ryan. In particular, a book of her poems called The Niagara River. These are poems that don't have explicit reference to the Holocaust, but they are poems that can be read in a way that relates to that disaster and catastrophe. And she's a wonderful poet. Her poems are simple but profound. And then last of all, I would mention an artist by the name of Samuel Bach, B-A-K, who is a prolific artist who, in one way or another, always has Holocaust on his mind. And he's done an amazing array of paintings. And as one person has said of Bach, Bach is an artist who paints questions. He paints questions. It's a really apt way of getting at what Samuel Bach is doing. And his paintings are available in catalog format in a wide variety of places. Anyone who would just Google the name Samuel Bach, B-A-K, would come up with lots of leads that would be fascinating to explore.
Well, it sounds like I have a good list of things to do this weekend. And at the beginning, I framed this book as kind of a valedictory, but I suspect this is not the last book you'll write. In fact, I know. What are you working on now?
Yeah, I'm working on a project right now. In fact, I'm expecting today to get the page proof for it. It's a project with Carol Rittner, the person I mentioned earlier a time or two. A very amazing woman who I've had the privilege of collaborating with on projects for some time. The new book that's coming out is a collection of essays, and the title is called Advancing Holocaust Studies. The project here was that Carol and I invited a group of Holocaust scholars to reflect on what needs to happen in the fraught times that we are in 2020, to advance the field of Holocaust studies. Indeed, does it even make sense to talk about trying to do that in the fraught times that we are in? So we asked people to reflect, and we gathered them together to talk about, you know, what is Holocaust studies for? What are its purposes? What are its goals? What are its assumptions, particularly in 2020 and moving forward in a time that is full of all kinds of difficulties, including now the novel coronavirus pandemic that is plaguing us. And so that's what this book is about. I think it'll be interesting to read. We have a good group of scholars who have decided to contribute to the project, and it'll be out later this summer.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating and important book, and I hope that you and or maybe you and Carol will be willing to come back and talk about it on the show.
That'd be great.
I think maybe you deserve, I may need to start some kind of frequent guest card where you get some kind of discount, but of course the podcast is free. So until then, stay safe and be well. And listeners, we've been listening to an interview with John Roth about his new book, Sources of Holocaust Insight, published by Cascade Books. Until next time, when I'll be with you to talk with Gabrielle Finder and Alexander Prusin about their book, Justice Behind the Iron Curtain, Nazis on Trial in Communist Poland. Until then, stay safe, and I'll talk to you again soon.